I've forgotten the actual question, which is this. Which is a word invented by Scott Jodelson, I think, who's one of the collaborators on part of what I'm going to talk about. So in the in Neil's talk a couple of days ago, he apologized that there might be a little disarray in his talk because he had too little time to prepare. So I have to make the opposite apology. There might be some disarray in my talk because I've had too much time to prepare.
That is, namely about 2 years. What that really means is it's been about 2 years since I thought seriously about the cosmological constant. I've been working on other things. I can't say I haven't thought about it at all. It's not possible, I think, not to think about the cosmological constant. But I haven't thought seriously about it. But nevertheless, Niyash asked me to talk. And although I don't have anything too new to say, I agreed because there's an idea that I want to talk about that I think deserves more work than it's received, and so I'm hoping to convince some of you that that's the case. So in some sense, actually, I have not 2 years to prepare on it, but I actually had 20 years because because it was actually about 20 years ago, I think, roughly, that I'd, based on some evidence from causal set theory and the way it was developing, I predicted that we'd probably see a non-zero cosmological constant, and its order of magnitude would be about 10 to the minus 120 in natural units. I think I remember there was a meeting at Maryland that was a birthday party for Dieter Brill and Charlie Misner, and I talked on quantum gravity in general. At the end, I said maybe the first evidence we'll see about quantum gravity won't be from looking at very small things, but looking up to the cosmos and seeing this non-zero cosmological constant. Which, so you can see, I thought that it, and I do think that it's essentially a quantum effect. So the remarkable thing is that this prediction came true. Now, if this happens to someone else, they make some outlandish prediction and it comes true, you probably say, well, they just got lucky. But if it happens to you, well, you can see. So I believe that that's really what's going on. And I want to give you some of the background to it. The prediction was heuristic and based on certain guesses about how causal set quantum gravity would go. And still, even now, there's no complete model to implement the prediction. But there is a partial model, and that's the work with Makbul, Scott, and Brian that I'll be talking about later. So what I want to do is explain this heuristic prediction, telling you just a little bit about causal sets, the minimum necessary to understand it, and then the partial realization of the prediction, and in the hope that you'll be convinced that it is worth more attention. Then at the end, I want to end with some remarks which are, I was hoping they'd be a bit provocative, but I'm not sure that after this conference that they will be. And specifically, I wanted to remark that the solution of the riddle of the cosmological constant has to rest on non-local physics, but maybe that's coming to be more and more a common view. So I wanted to mention the main weakness, which you'll see of this partial model and what needs improvement, among other things, is that it's still limited to an assumption of spatial homogeneity. So that's the thing to keep in mind. So I think in this audience and in this conference, there's really very little need to review the cosmological constant riddle problem, as some people call it. But so let me go very quickly through that. This is another possible title for the talk. So now we have the third title. They're all getting all with the same meaning, basically. So as everyone is familiar with, the cosmological constant originated, began life as a non-solution to a non-problem. Right? So the non-problem, of course, well, here is the cosmological constant, and here kappa is the 8 pi g, the convenient one for cosmology, the rationalized Newton's constant. The non-problem was that the Einstein equations do not allow a static universe if lambda equals zero. The non-solution was that the Einstein equations do not allow a static universe if lambda is not equal to zero. So given this inauspicious beginning, maybe people just decided to trash the whole idea. And until about a decade ago, so now it's 2 years later since I wrote this, so let's say until 8 years ago, no one believed in lambda, and they either just set it to zero without even mentioning it, or set it to zero with mentioning it. Since then, of course, everything has changed due to the whole wealth of evidence that's come in. And again, I think there's little need to review it. So let me just flash up a couple of things. So I guess the two single strongest pieces of evidence come from the acoustic peaks in the cosmic microwave relic radiation and from the type 1a supernova. Each one of them is, in some sense, a geometrical thing, if I understand how they work. In this one, basically, you're using the sort of largest fluctuations in the CMB, this acoustic peak. You're using them as a kind of standard ruler. And in the case of the supernova data, you're using the supernova as a standard candle. This one is somehow the nicest one, I think, the supernova in itself, because it relies on so little physics input. All you really need to know, if you accept that the supernovas are standard candles, all you really need to know is how light propagates in a curved background. You don't need to know anything about the Einstein equations being true or more general gravity. And so that makes it somehow the cleanest probe. Basically, it gives you, you plot the redshift against the luminosity. Well, astronomers, just to confuse us, have plotted against the dimness instead of the luminosity. And then to make it even more confusing, they change the name of the dimness to the luminosity distance or something. But you see a curve like this. And basically, you get one function of one variable. And the scale factor as a function of proper time is also one function of one variable. So in principle, you get the scale factor fully, and then you can plug it into the Einstein equation with or without cosmological constant and dark energy, and deduce what you should get. And of course, you get this acceleration, which is not possible in the Einstein equation without cosmological constant, because there's no repulsion, no gravitational repulsion in that case. So the upshot of all that evidence is, of course, that lambda does have a magnitude in terms of the Planck, the rationalized Planck length, of about 10 to the minus 120. That raises, obviously, two questions. First of all, which one was already there, a riddle, was why is lambda zero? And the second question is, of course, why is lambda not zero? But more to the point, why is it that there's another coincidence, which is lambda is not only not zero, but it's very near to the critical density of 3 times the Hubble constant squared, which is the density that takes exactly to close the universe, make it flat. Another way of saying it, since we do live in an approximately flat, spatially flat universe, another way of saying it is that rho is very near to the density of the ambient matter, the ordinary and not so ordinary dark matter within a factor, within an order of magnitude, they're equal. So is that just an accident of when we happen to be looking at it, or does it have some sort of deeper meaning? That's the question. Sometimes people call this the why now problem, but that posing it that way betrays a certain prejudice, which is the prejudice that lambda actually, not an unreasonable prejudice, but it's a prejudice that lambda actually was always constant. Then you have to say, why did it just now come to have the same strength as the ambient matter? But if it's not constant, then that's not necessarily a meaningful question. So I'd like to pose it this way. Why is lambda near in its gravitational effect to that of the ambient matter? Now, one way that this could not be a coincidence, that this could be explained, would be, if it was always true, if it was always of the order of magnitude of 8 squared. However, that is not, that has problems. So one of them is that if lambda had been in the recent, always of the order of magnitude of 8 squared, well, in the recent past, and always of the order of magnitude of the ambient, well, I haven't written it, of the ambient matter, then if you think in the past, 10 billion years or so, of course, the universe was smaller, matter was denser, the Hubble constant was greater, and so lambda would have been greater. And it being having a repulsive effect, it would have increased the expansion. That would have tended to pull apart galaxies. And I mean, it would have meant that the amount of structure formation, the amount of clumpiness that we saw, would be less, and it wouldn't agree with the clumpiness that we see in the CMB, at least so my friends tell me. And the same thing for nucleosynthesis. If at the time of nucleosynthesis, lambda had been near h squared, then you would have had even more rapid expansion at that time. The whole process would have been over sooner, and the abundances wouldn't match the ones that do match well when you assume lambda about zero. So this is bad if lambda is always of the order of magnitude of h squared and same sign, but neither of these arguments exclude a fluctuating lambda whose order of magnitude, I mean, whose absolute value is comparable to h squared in order of magnitude, but whose average sign is zero. In other words, it could also be negative. So what I want to convince you is that it's possible that there can be fluctuations in the cosmological constant like this, and that they can arise as a residual, non-local, and quantum effect of an underlying spatiotemporal discreteness. So they would be, in some way, a direct window into the Planck world, or let's say an indirect window into the Planck world. So to convince you that, I have to, this comes, as I said before, out of causal sets, in part, so I have to review some of the features of causal set theory, just those that we need for present purposes. So according to this point of view,
But if the cosmological constant has fluctuated in the past, then there are presumably boundaries between when it had different values when the Einstein equations were not satisfied.
Yeah.
So wouldn't those show up somehow observationally?
They should, yeah. And so the original prediction, which I haven't quite got to, only gave an order of magnitude. It didn't tell us, it didn't give us a more complete model of how the variations took place. In this particular model, which has some ad hoc elements, but which I'll talk about, it is possible to say that. And it actually typically undergoes some sort of Brownian motion in that model. And certainly there should be, I don't know if there'll be sharp boundaries, but Brownian motion is sort of an irregular kind of process. So you, if you...
As you know well, the Einstein, the Bianchi identities are not satisfied. The equations fall apart. So, you know, look, if we're seeing through the CMB or through anything, any signal that passed through such regions, wouldn't we know it somehow?
Well, I think so let me slightly put the question off till I show the model, and then you'll see that, and as you say, of course, it doesn't satisfy the full Einstein equation. It involves a modification of the Einstein equation. I think probably the biggest signature that you'd see would be small fluctuations, and also negative. If we see that the effect of lambda is negative sometimes, I think that's one of the easiest things to pick out, at least this proposal from other possible ones. And just today I got an email that said someone gave a seminar at Imperial College in which they see signs of small relatively rapid fluctuations in the dark energy. Now, at the end of the email, they said it was only a one sigma effect, or a little bit more than one sigma. But I applied Bayesian statistics to it and put in my prior, and so I gave it. So maybe we're seeing that. But I'll say something more.
I don't think there'll be, I'm not saying there'll be sharp boundaries. In other words, it won't be one lambda and then suddenly jump to another lambda, but you're going to see a sort of, well, let me show the model. So in the causal set, hypothesis is that space-time is not deep down continuous. It's atomic in nature. It's made of individual elements, and these elements have on them, they don't carry a topology, they don't carry a metric, or there's no tensor field defined on them or something. It's a discrete structure. The only internal thing that differentiates them from a heap of unrelated elements is this order relation, a partial order, strictly speaking. This order can be thought of as before and after in time. It can also be thought of as ancestry, because the natural dynamics for this is one of sequential growth, in which the elements are born sequentially, with some being the parents and so on, and some being the descendants of others. And this whole pattern of order relationships or ancestral relationships is what defines the causal sets. Notice that in this process of growth, which is the hypothesized dynamics for the causal set, the role, this will be important later in the argument, that the role, the number of elements plays the role of a kind of time parameter. The elements are born one by one. It's partly a gauge time, because it's important that it not enter too much into the physics, or that would conflict with general covariance, but or label invariance in this case. But it does play the role of a gauge time. So this sounds a little strange at first hearing. How can you have something that has no metric on it and so on, no topology in it? What could it possibly have to do with space-time? Well, the answer is that we have order information and we have number information. And if we assume that the microscopic order that defines the causal set, this is a symbol for order, that the microscopic order corresponds to the macroscopic relation of before and after, in other words, the causal order of space-time. And if we assume that the number of, and we will assume that the number of elements, in fact, this is the most important assumption to keep in mind, we will assume that the number of elements corresponds to volume of space-time. So what this means is that if you have some region of space-time, not space, but space-time, and you measure its volume in some way in Planck units, then you'll get a very large number. And that number, in effect, is really just the number of elements of the causal set that compose that region of space-time. If we assume those two things, then we have all the information that it takes to reconstruct a geometry. We have order information that gives you light cones, and we have volume information that gives you root minus g. And it turns out that if you know the light cones and you know root minus g, then you know the full metric. So in fact, there is, the information is there. However, with one important, I now have to make one important qualification to what I said. I said that the number of elements equals the space-time volume. It appears that it's not possible to make a correspondence between the causal set and the continuum so that that's an exact relationship. The closest you can come is one that has Poisson fluctuations in the relationship, so that the number of elements is equal to the volume up to Poisson fluctuations, which are root n fluctuations. Since n is almost the same as v, we can also call them root v fluctuations. So this will be an important equation, that the number of elements composing a region of space-time is the volume of that region. This is the same v that Aharon was using, it's the space-time volume, up to these root v fluctuations. Okay, so to summarize this idea, then, number plus order gives rise to geometry. We still lack a quantum dynamics of sequential growth for causal sets, but there is a classical one, and that we can be partly guided by that. The main guide we need here is to associate number of elements with a kind of time parameter. So I should stop. So are there any questions on that particular?
Maybe it's unfamiliar.
So how does this collection of ideas lead to the fluctuations in the cosmological constant. So let's assume, well, it seems quite reasonable, in fact, to assume that, whatever the deep dynamics of the theory is, at the effective level, we'll see something like a gravitational path integral, which I maintain we don't understand even in the continuum as well as we should. And that's, I think that also came up in your talk, right? If we understood the path integral better, we could make more progress in sorting out some of these issues. But certainly we have a sense of what it's like. We know how to use it in many situations. So we would expect that the effective dynamics would be something like a gravitational path integral. At a deeper level, however, this path integral won't be a sum over four geometries, it'll be a sum over causal sets. Now, we said before that the number of elements correspond is a kind of time parameter. When you do the quantum mechanical path integral, you don't sum over time, you hold time fixed. Correspondingly, it seems natural to hold fixed in this sum over causal set, to hold the number of elements fixed. Which up to this fluctuation means in the corresponding continuum path integral, you would hold fixed the four volume. Now there's a name for theories which hold the four volume fixed. It's called unimodular gravity. Sometimes people don't describe it that way, but in the path integral point of view, the most natural way to describe unimodular gravity and the easiest way to see why it does not, in fact, break general covariance at all is to view it as a kind of path integral in which the volume is held fixed. Or another way of saying it is that two different metrics don't interfere with each other unless their four volumes are equal. So in this theory, which we'll hear much, we've heard a little bit about yesterday, the Maharon, whose proposal basically is, I think, unimodular gravity, a form of it. And we'll hear, I think, more about it from Lee this afternoon. So I won't say too much, except to stress one fact that comes out very clearly in the unimodular formulation, is that gravitationally, the four volume and lambda, the cosmological constant, are conjugates to each other in the same sense that energy and time are conjugate to each other in ordinary quantum mechanics. In fact, the analogy, I think, is quite close. So I won't say too much, but one way of seeing why this is true is just look at the term in the action that corresponds to the cosmological constant. If you integrate it out, it's just lambda v, which is just like ET. So I think although we don't even, you know, there's some dispute about what the time energy uncertainty relation means, and there can be, I think, far more dispute over what exactly this conjugacy means, which we may understand better if we do understand the gravitational path integral better. Nevertheless, I think it's on pretty firm grounds that in some sense or other, these are conjugate and we can expect a kind of uncertainty relation between them. So we can expect that fluctuations in lambda and fluctuations in V are related by this relationship. Now let's bring in, so this is somehow the key point for at least the first part of the talk before I get to the detailed model. If we now bring in the fluctuations, this formula here that I wrote down, that the number of elements, if it's held fixed, V is not actually held fixed, but it's fixed only up to fluctuations of an order of magnitude root V. If we plug that into the fluctuations in V, then for fluctuations in lambda, we get 1 over root V. Now, this is only telling us about the fluctuation. Now I'm going to make another assumption for which I won't give any argument. It is the cosmological constant problem, as people call it. But I'll say something about it right at the end. But I'm just going to assume that for reasons that for the moment we don't understand, that the value about which the fluctuations take place is zero. The target value, so to speak, for lambda is zero. If that's true, then the fluctuations are the value of lambda itself. And a prediction of the magnitude of fluctuations is a prediction of the observed magnitude of lambda. Now, if we put that in, we get 10 to the 100 minus 120. Why is that? Let's assume, what is V here? Let's assume that V should be identified with the space-time volume of the visible universe. Well, if you work that out, so that's the universe since the Big Bang, in units of, I think it's about 10 to the minus 139 centimeter cubed second. So if you work that out, you get about 10 to the 240. And if you take the square roots, of course, so V is about 10 to the 240. And the square root of that sort of inverse is equal to 10 to the minus 120. So that's where that prediction came from.
You know, that patch at redshift of 1,000 and that patch at redshift of 1,000, their volumes were smaller, so fluctuations were larger. But if it but I should see different values.
Well, that's the key question that we don't know how to answer, because you'll see when we make the model that the only way so far we've been able to make the model is by assuming spatial homogeneity. But so I can only answer part of your question. If those two are at different times, then we should certainly see difference. I mean, in the model, I can only answer part of your question. So whether this V is, I don't know exactly how to identify V. If it's some sort of more global effect, the answer to your question might be no. If it's just the local past of that region, the answer would be yes. And of course, then there's a danger of overproducing fluctuations.
Yeah.
Enormous. What?
Yeah.
But when you assume that it's sort of specially homogeneous, assume that there are some correlations beyond the causal kind of times, right?
That's right, it would be. Although it's not really beyond the, it's not really because uncausal because we don't know what was happening at the time of the Big Bang. But it's if we cut things off after that, then of course it would be beyond causal. There would have to be some sort of quantum, non-local type of correlation. This is, you're putting your finger on exactly where the model needs to be developed further.
Even causally connected, they can be different.
Certainly in time they'll be different. Well, you see the model, so in time they'll be different. So the idea is the fluctuations will be larger. Let me not say because I would just be making speculation. So especially as I said, I haven't thought about it too much recently. But this is how things stood. This was the key outstanding question at the time. And still is a key outstanding. Some work has been done recently by Mark Poole on this, but I cannot present to you yet a model that would answer these questions and tell to what extent there's a dependence or independence of the fluctuations, especially separated regions. So, if we assume that lambda is zero, then we get this number and you can say more. You can now bring in a hand waving argument, which will become, which will be able to actually justify in the detailed model that I'll show you, which is that the volume, which shows that we expect this ever present lambda that will always be around the closure density. So the hand waving argument is this: if the volume of space time is typically around the Hubble radius to the fourth, and you plug that in, then you get lambda is typically about the Hubble radius squared, plugging that in here, which is about the critical density. So I want to point out just that this, this ever-present character of lambda is special to 3+1 dimension. If you do the same derivation in another dimension, you find something different.
Which case is not a constant.
It certainly won't be constant. Yeah.
But then if it goes like h squared, it's just a renormalization of g Newton.
This is not fair.
It's just a renormalization of g Newton.
Well, no, it's not. It's fluctuating. I don't see why.
But if you get a contribution to the energy density that goes like h squared, that does nothing. It just renormalizes g.
It's a random free factor, so it's not always a constant.
Yeah, it's changing. So let me show you the simulation.
But then you effectively g neutral is fluctuating.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. You're saying that there's another language for it in which we could say that you're using the sponge writing, is that true?
Yeah.
Okay, let me think about that. When you see the model, then you can... so here's the... Okay, so now we want to make a model incorporating this idea. Let's speed up a little bit. So make a model incorporating this idea. The first thing that we have to decide is how to interpret this. Lee already raised this question, and it came up also in effect in the last question, which is how do we interpret V and how do we interpret lambda in that relationship that I wrote? So how do we interpret the change of lambda? As far as V, I'll just make, in order to get a meaning to variation in lambda, we were forced so far to make this ansatz of spatial homogeneity. Given that it's natural to interpret V as just being the past volume to some point on the hypersurface in question, or in terms of causal set, that we're just talking about V being the number of ancestors of that corresponding element. Once we do that, then we still have the question of how to interpret a change in lambda. As already was mentioned, you can't just write down the Einstein equations and let lambda be a function of time. That's inconsistent. So, however, within the context of a spatially homogeneous metric, in other words, the Friedman, Robertson, Walker form, we can give it a meaning. When you write the equations in that form, then they reduce to two equations, very familiar, I guess. This one is called the Friedman equation, or maybe both are called the Friedman equation. I'm not sure what the terminology is exactly. But they're both familiar equations. And when lambda, here I wrote rho lambda, you just read that as lambda. And p lambda, I wrote, read that as minus lambda. When lambda is constant, the second equation is not independent from the first. It follows by differentiating the first, and so you need only the first. So in making this model, this ansatz, what I'm going to do is just keep the first equation and let the second equation, in which rho lambda equals lambda, and let the second equation do what it wants, which basically means p lambda will depend on the time derivative of lambda. So this looks a bit ad hoc, and it is a bit ad hoc. Since then, Makbul has looked at the effect of using some different linear combination of these two equations instead of just the first one. And qualitatively, it turns out it doesn't make too much difference, although you have to be careful not to use an unstable combination of the two equations. Okay, so now we have almost what we need to evolve the universe in this approximation. If we know lambda, we know the right-hand side. If we know A, we know A, the scale factor. We can get from this equation A dot. That can evolve it to the next moment of time. The only thing that we don't know is what to put in for lambda. We need to do that in such a way that it fluctuates, and the magnitude of the fluctuations is the one given by 1 over root V on average. So it turns out, in other words, we need a stochastic law of evolution for lambda, which has this property that delta lambda is about 1 over root V. So here's a way to do this. It's in a way, it looks like it might even have a deeper meaning, but I'm just treating it now as an ansatz that does what we want. So let's suppose, to see why this ansatz works, why it gives you this right magnitude of the fluctuations, notice that you can think of lambda in a slightly different way. You can think of, by definition, because the volume, the term in the action that involves lambda is just the volume times lambda, we could say that lambda is the action per unit volume. This is just the action per unit volume, just due to space-time itself. But volume, remember, is number of elements, and therefore
We could also say that lambda is the action per unit element when expressed in Planckian units. If we then make an ansatz in which we call something the action corresponding to a certain volume of space-time, if we make an ansatz in which that fluctuates by root n, then the fluctuations in lambda, which is action over n, will be 1 over root n as we want, which is 1 over root v. Well, there's an obvious way to do that, which is just by a random walk, if you like. Suppose that in this ansatz, each element of the causal set contributes either plus or minus 1 to the action. Then we will get this relationship, as I just said. The fluctuations will be of the desired magnitude. In terms of the ordinary units, the fluctuations in lambda will be 1 over root b times Planck, times measured in Planck units, times L to the fourth, where L is an unknown parameter. It's the conversion, which always occurs in discrete gravity theories. It's the conversion factor between volume in natural units, or length, sorry, in natural units, and length in the Planckian units, which we make from Planck's constant, the speed of light, and the gravitational constant. So it's an unknown free parameter, but it should be of order 1, roughly. Having done it, so we can go through, since I'm running a little short of time, I won't go through any details. That defines the model. You can simulate the model, and here's the result. So the question is, will we see this ever-present character? Was that hand-waving argument that I gave right or not? So here's the results. On the horizontal axis, we've plotted the scale factor. This is for a particular value of this L, which is about order 3.16 in this particular simulation. There are three curves here. One is matter density, one is the radiation density, and one is lambda. The thick curve is the fluctuating lambda. This is log plot, so the fluctuations are bigger than they look. But you see that you never see more than two curves. That's because lambda exactly tracks whichever is the dominant component of the matter. So in the early times when radiation is dominant, it exactly tracks that. And in late times when matter is dominant, it exactly tracks that. So the answer is it is in fact ever present in this sense. So that hand-waving argument, in four dimensions anyway, worked out. If you want to see the actual fluctuations in, this is a different run with a slightly different value of L. The fluctuations at the last, up to Redshift of 1,000 or so, you see lambda looking like this. So it's the fine structure of lambda is something like this. You see that up to a redshift of about 1, it was roughly, I mean, we chose one in which it has a positive value today. It didn't have to happen. Up to redshift of about 1, it's roughly constant with these small fluctuations, and then it becomes irregular. So that would be the typical prediction for how lambda behaves. You'd like to know what's the probability of getting something like what we see. So here's a histogram of the final value of lambda over many runs. Now, the final value of lambda is not exactly the same as the fitting parameter that goes into the data reduction, but it's qualitatively similar. And so you see you get something qualitatively like what you want, except maybe a hint that there's not quite enough fluctuations there. So that's the end of the that's the end of the main points, which is first of all to show the heuristic prediction, second of all to show the particular model that realizes this to some extent, and then the rest are questions. and summary. So here's some questions. Again, it seems a short of time, so I'll just, I won't even talk about them, just to show that there, one of them, one that was raised about the spatial homogeneity is there, and that's one for which, as yet, we don't have a good answer, one I mentioned in the introduction. So let me, what I do want to summarize, and then make a few other remarks, which were, is so, which, so-called provocative. Some of them, I think, will still be a little bit provocative. But the summary is that causal sets predicted fluctuations in lambda about 1 over root b, or an observed value of plus or minus 1 over root b. There's no prediction, as you saw, for the sign, only for the order of magnitude. So from that point of view, it's just luck that it came out positive. We can call that confirmed.
Because the same prediction is also ruled out at higher redshift, right?
That's what remains to be seen.
Well, like we bank the synthesis.
Oh, yeah, but suppose that it, well, so it could have been negative. So this is getting a little bit into my provocative remark, but it could also have been negative at that time. It could have been zero. In fact, as you saw on the histogram.
So then it's not a prediction.
The most likely, well, it was a prediction. I mean, this is just a historical. Yeah, but it's a random process. So what you want to say is that if you sample it at a random time, the typical value will be plus or minus this. Mm-hmm. But of course, that's right. It could be zero at some time. So let me come back to that.
So a full understanding of this prediction awaits a quantum causal set dynamics, a real dynamics for causal sets. Meantime, we have a reasonably coherent model, which is based on simple general arguments. So far, it's consistent with observations, but all these questions need to be addressed. It solves the why-no problem, because lambda is not just important now, it's always important. And it makes predictions. It predicts that we won't see p equals minus rho. It predicts that we'll see, if we look at the appropriate epoch, we'll see a negative lambda. The other comments, since I skipped over some things, don't make sense here. Let me just dwell on the last two things. One is that it's special to e equals 4. If you go through that hand waving, I mean, I want to give that hand waving argument that said that you would get ever present behavior. And the simulations confirmed that. We haven't done simulations in other dimensions, but the same hand-waving argument, if you do it in other dimensions, shows you that, I forget which way it is, but I think that in dimensions below 4, lambda always dominates. In dimensions above 4, matter always dominates. So it's always tempting to make up a scenario in which the cosmological constants, in which this fact is the explanation of why we live in 4 dimensions. For example, the universe starts off and then expanding, and then it can't get very far because the lambda fluctuations are dominating it, it recontracts and so on. And only when it hits 4 dimensions does it have the chance of keeping going. So to summarize what, at least what I'm trying to say in almost the whole talk is that a joke is that the word constant in the phrase cosmological constant has the same meaning as the word constant in the phrase Hubble constant. Okay. Let me say a couple of other things about the other half of the problem, which is why is what? Getting close to the end. Two things then. Maybe I'll leave out the question. I was going to say something about why is lambda near zero? Why is it fluctuating about zero and some other value? So let me just take two things having to do with observation. Obviously, if we think that lambda is changing, we should be looking for situations like Ghazal was telling us where the lambda CDM fails. One example came up in a talk the other day where overproduction of dark matter could now be a good thing, because it would be compatible with the observations. It would just mean that the fluctuation made the lambda negative at that time to cancel the gravitational effect of the excess in dark matter. the other thing I wanted to say is that if you believe this account of where the cosmological constant comes from, then this excludes large extra dimension scenarios. The reason is fairly simple, because in those scenarios, the Planck length is much bigger than we thought it was, so the fundamental length is much bigger. There are far fewer elements. The magnitude of the fluctuations is then smaller, and you get a prediction of a much too small cosmological constant. And I'll just finish now with something which I'll just state. If someone wants to ask, I can say why I'm saying this, is that I think that the answer to why lambda is so small will involve local physics, non-local physics, at least in the effective level, if not in the fundamental level. And furthermore, that in a discrete theory like causal sets, the puzzle of why lambda is so small merges with another puzzle, which is always there for anyone doing a discrete theory, which is why does the manifold exist at all? In other words, why do we see anything like a space-time on large scales? If we answer that, then a fortiori, we will have also had to answer why lambda is so small. So I'm suggesting that maybe there's a fruitful reformulation of the problem that people can think about quickly.
A couple of questions.
Yeah.
I think we actually have a number of constraints on the time variation of the Hubble constant being near the initial value at early times, right? The Bang-Hugging synthesis would be different if the Hubble rate was different then. The CMB power spectrum would be different. I mean, recombination would happen differently. So even if there's, I think there'd be enormous CMB fluctuations if there was variations of the Hubble constant from patch to patch. But even if you did a homogeneous slice,
yes, I don't.
I think it's actually pretty well constrained at early times to be close to the fiducial value, because one can't have delta.
We can affect the zero.
Well, the Hubble constant, Hubble rate is close to the fiducial number, right? That if it was off by factor two, uh-huh, the fluctuations were order unity, which is what this model seems to imply,
yeah,
then nucleus synthesis would be quite different, recombination would be quite different, and that would change the number of free electrons, would change the CMB power spectrum significantly. And we have to do the calculation to see whether it's a 10% constraint or, but certainly, but much better than order unity.
Until we have a way of handling, studying the process of fluctuations in this model, I think it's an open question.
Well, that's not just the fluctuations. It's just the homogeneous cosmology.
Yes, but then strictly homogeneous cosmology doesn't allow for fluctuations at all. But if you want to put it on top of the usual fluctuations equations, then I don't know. Remember that there's fluctuations in sun, so if you average this over a period of time, you're going to see something near to zero. The question is whether the instantaneous fluctuations, so to speak, drive you away from that average behavior enough. I'm not sure. In the case of Big Bang nuclear synthesis, there's definitely tension there. But it would be nicer if we would find something else that would contribute to the matter density at the time of Big Bang nuclear synthesis. And you could say that this was negative. The question is, what are the... So this is a stochastic theory, and you have to say something like, what is the probability of lambda behaving in the way that it needed to match observations? If we get more and more data, and each time it had to be unlikely small in that period in order to fit the observations, then obviously the idea will die. We have to find some situations where lambda CDM doesn't fit well in order to make this more plausible observation.
Well, I suppose there are no more questions.